What? What? What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Ridge.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is actor Joshua Bitton, talking about his new film, For the Love of Money. We'll also have visits from our Too Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our maven on Israel, Guy Gilbert. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio@Yahoo.com or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. This is the week of that great American commemoration, the 4th of July, the day of fireworks, baseball, barbecues, and the celebration of freedom. As Jews, we've been uniquely blessed to experience true religious freedom here in the United States, and while we have contributed greatly to this country, we have also received greatly. To play us in on this summer morning on Too Jewish on the theme of Independence Day, here's Mandy Patinkin's Yiddish version of that Irving Berlin classic, God Bless America. This time it's Gott Bench America, but blended with that most American of all sports and songs, also written by a Jewish guy, by the way, Take Me Out to the Ball Game.
mir doch kein Koif mir den Nislo von Cracker Jack Will ich kein Mul von dort nicht a weg Jetzt ein Mut, 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 die Ballspieler Es passt nicht, als ein Verspiel Weil sie sehen, zwei, drei Spikes Neues bei der Baseballspiel America, land wo sich lieb, steh je bei ihr, madrig sei ihr, überall Pascal und Schlieb, von die Berge zu den Prairies, bis die Arme weiß mit Schau.
Okay, so now we're fully ready for the 4th of July this week, thanks to Mandy Patinkin. By the way, next week on Too Jewish, we'll hear about a very important piece of American history that is going on display at the American Jewish History Museum, George Washington's letter to the Jews of Newport, Rhode Island. The curator of that wonderful Philadelphia museum will be on Too Jewish. I recently returned from Israel, having led an interfaith pilgrimage trip for my own congregation, Temple Emmanuel of Tucson, Arizona, in partnership with St. Philip's in the Hills Episcopal Church and its rector, John Kitagawa. If you've been listening to Too Jewish, you know that, of course. Last week, I gave you a bit of an overview of the experience, but today I want to focus on the biggest news story that hit while we were in Israel, and one that promises to have lasting impact on Israeli society. It was the decision that some Reform rabbis, or at least one, but going forward another 15, are going to receive salaries from the Israeli government as, believe it or not, rabbis. For the first time that I can recall, Israeli newspapers and media highlighted a story about progressive Judaism as the lead story. In a landmark decision by the Israeli Attorney General's office, Rabbi Miri Gold, a Reform rabbi from Kibbutz Gezer, right in the heart of Israel, will be recognized officially as a rabbi of a non-Orthodox community, and she will receive wages equal to those of her Orthodox counterparts. This decision follows a series of Israeli Supreme Court decisions supporting Reform and conservative conservative movement rabbis in recent years, but the official move by the government marks a real substantive change in the status and professional prospects of all liberal rabbis in Israel and of the reform movement there. Rabbi Miri Gold actually met with our group in Tel Aviv the Friday morning after that decision, which was fascinating. It was a little bit like meeting Rosa Parks a week after the school bus incident. Well, we'll have Miri Gold on Too Jewish in a couple of weeks to come, too. Anyway, the Miri Gold decision, of course, sparked a firestorm of responses, both extremely positive and harshly critical in Israel, depending on where you fall on the Jewish religious spectrum. The resolution of her case marked a huge victory for the reform movement's Israel Religious Action Center and its head, Anat Hoffman, a guest of Too Jewish exactly a year ago, by the way, and for progressive rabbis throughout Israel and for reform and conservative movements everywhere in the world. It's a tremendous shot in the arm for pluralistic Judaism in Israel, homeland of the Jewish world and the second largest and fastest growing Jewish population in the world. As Reform Rabbi Maya Leibovich of Jerusalem said, liberal movements reflect the fact that Elu ve'elu divrei Elohim chayim, both Orthodox and Reform and conservative Judaism, are all the words of the living God of Israel. The importance of the decision is that it set a model for relations between the non-Orthodox movements and the government, Rabbi Gilad Kariv said at the time. He's the executive director of Israel's Reform Movement and an upcoming guest of Too Jewish as well in a couple of weeks, as a matter of fact. Rabbi Gerald Skolnick, who is the president of the Rabbinical Assembly, the conservative organization of rabbis, called the attorney general's decision a dramatic step forward in the struggle for religious pluralism in Israel. Well and good. However, for the Orthodox leadership, and especially the ultra-Orthodox political leadership in Israel, this Miri Gold decision is a huge setback, and they are fiercely angry. The chairman of the Habayit HaYehudi political party, a member of Knesset named Daniel Hershkovitz, who is also in the cabinet as science and technology minister, met with Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu and said it's not possible that decisions concerning the Jewish state should be given over to legal advisors and bureaucratic clerks. They are not able to decide who is fitting to bear a smicha, a rabbinical ordination. Hershkovitz had no problem with the same legal advisors and clerks deciding that Orthodox rabbis qualified to receive state funding and signing their checks, of course. Other prominent Orthodox politicians were even less circumspect. United Torah Judaism's chairman, Yisrael Eichler, said that Reform Jews have decreed upon themselves assimilation and destruction. Their offspring marry Gentiles, their sanctuaries are empty, and their homes are deserted. Well, not my home, and certainly not our sanctuary, thank you very much. But the capper comment came from Shas member of Knesset Nisim Zev, who said that the Israeli government has no authority to designate as rabbis people who falsify the Torah. This is the beginning of the destruction of the Jewish people in the land of Israel. You know, apparently I didn't know I was supposed to be falsifying the Torah as a Reform rabbi. I guess I'm just not cutting edge enough. I'm behind the times. Well, let's have some perspective on this and also some clarity on what the issues are. First, in Israel, unlike America, synagogues and rabbis are state supported. That means that rabbis are employees of the government and religious institutions get tax money to function. Unlike the U.S., there is no big charitable deduction donation push to support temples. This is also how most churches and synagogues are funded in Europe, by the way, where they don't know from the separation of church and state. Second, while the Reform Movement has long advocated full separation of religion and state in Israel, as it is in the U.S., it just doesn't work that way. And until now, the government of Israel has only supported Orthodox institutions and rabbis. That means that all reforming conservative institutions and rabbis are paid for by donations, mostly from overseas. This imbalance makes it easy to provide Orthodox rabbis in schools for Israelis free of apparent charge. Well, you know, the taxes are already paid, but very costly and difficult to provide progressive or liberal Jewish rabbis and synagogues who don't get money from the state. This unfairness and skewed field of play has made it extremely difficult for Reform Judaism to gain a foothold in Israel. Over the past 50 years, nonetheless, the Reform Movement, and to a lesser degree the conservative Masoreti Movement, has grown slowly but steadily in Israel. While most Israelis don't attend the local Orthodox shul at all, an increasing number have begun to seek spirituality in Reform settings. But it remains a small percentage of all those Israelis who tend to view themselves as chilonim, purely secular. They do almost never attend temple. What this Miri Gold decision means for the progressive movement in Israel, and by the way, reform and conservative are much closer to each other in Israel than in the States, is that there will be more money and official support for these movements in Israel, which means that more Israelis will be able to find a form of Jewish expression that speaks to their needs today. You know, it's hard to see how fewer Israelis saying they are not religious and starting to attend reform and conservative synagogues can be a bad thing. And this is just the tip of the iceberg. There are some 60 Reform rabbis waiting to apply for compensation and government recognition all around Israel. So it was big news for the Reform movement and good news for non-Orthodox Judaism in Israel. To play us in a bit more on that theme, here's the wonderful combo from Congregation Kehilat HaLev from their CD Lev Tahor, A Song of Ascents, Shir HaMa'alot, from the Psalms.
Shir ha-ma'alot mi-ma'amakim k'ratikha Elohim Adon
That was Shir HaMa'alot, A Song of Ascents from the Psalms, and Lev Tahor, Rabbi Or Zohar's combo from the small new Reform synagogue, Kehilat HaLev, in Tel Aviv, Israel. When we come back on Two Jewish in just a few moments, actor Joshua Bitton will tell us about his new film, For the Love of Money, which has an Israeli origin and story, when we return on Two Jewish.
Hi, Joe Spina, Mama's Pizza. People sometimes ask me if I ever go to other restaurants and try their pizza. The answer is definitely yes. In fact, the other day I went to another restaurant to sample their pizza. So how did it compare to Mama's? Well, first of all, the crust tasted sweet. By that, I mean they added extra sugar to the dough. At Mama's, we don't add extra sugar to any of our food. The blend of fresh, natural ingredients we use makes our food taste, well, fresh and natural. Now, there's one more thing I noticed about the other pizza. Based on the portion size and price, I paid about 1.5 times more for it than one of ours. In this economy, that's a pretty big deal. So I guess one reason I try other restaurants is that it makes me realize Mama's Pizza is one of the best. And that's a very sweet feeling. Mama's Pizza with 4 convenient locations. Check them out at mamasfamous.com. Now repeat after me. Mama's Pizza!
Parents in Tucson have many choices on where to send their children to school. Consider the best. Consider Tucson Hebrew Academy. Now is the time to secure your spot for the upcoming school year. With a beautiful Foothills K-8 campus and award-winning academics, you owe it to your children to visit THA, Tucson Hebrew Academy, and see what they have to offer. Your child belongs at THA. THA delivers. Low student-teacher ratio supports successful, rigorous academics, and they don't stop there. With an emphasis on the arts, science, and music, THA students learn the Hebrew language and are taught Jewish values along with a rigorous academic curriculum. Your child deserves the best. Call 529-3888 to schedule your tour of THA. Financial aid is available. Don't wait. Space is limited. That's 529-3888 or visit www.thaaz.org. We're delighted to welcome the two Jewish art guests this morning, actor Joshua Bitton. He grew up in New York, made his mark in Steven Spielberg and Tom Hanks' miniseries The Pacific, which was the second installment, by the way, of The Band of Brothers, along with many roles in film and television. Josh has worked extensively in the theater. His new role is in a film called For the Love of Money, the true story of an Israeli whose journey to success in America embroils him in, eventually, lots and lots of trouble. Josh has played roles ranging from a homicidal private to a gay activist to a mentally disturbed degenerate gambler, and somehow to each he has brought a common humanity and likability. This time he actually plays an upstanding good guy. Is that a weird change of roles for you?
It's pretty shocking. usually there's a bit of an edge and something, let's say, off center for the characters I play.
So
I played someone that, you know, the audience could just kind of root for from start to finish was actually really kind of fun and bizarre.
I always wondered, you know, as an actor, is it easier to play someone weird or somebody likable?
I think it depends. I think it depends on where you come from and what sort of comes easy to you. I don't know what that says about me after what I just said about the roles that I normally play.
Right.
But I think it really just depends. You know, some people are really comfortable going to those strange places, and some people just have a natural charm that makes them, you know, those lovable characters.
Tell us a little bit about the film. Interesting story.
Yeah, very much so. The story is based on the life of Isaac Shomoff, who is our producer, and he's a pretty remarkable guy. You know, he came to the States at the age of 13 when his family in Israel ran into some trouble with some gangsters. I guess his parents ran basically an underground casino, and, you know...
That might leave you susceptible to that kind of trouble.
Exactly. And so, you know, they had sword characters there would come in and out, and it went really bad one day, and they had to leave the country, and they moved to L.A. And, you know, this is a kid who really came from nothing, and what he saw in L.A., you know, really, I think, filled him with this idea that he just wanted more. And he's a pretty remarkable success story. And what he went through, you know... To get there is pretty amazing. Some of the things he overcame is pretty remarkable.
We will talk much more with actor Joshua Bitton, who's in the new film For the Love of Money. Very interesting Israeli story when we come back in a few moments on Too Jewish.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle.
It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, Kvetch or Kvel, please email us at 2JewishRadio@yahoo.com or visit our website at 2JewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through our website or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store as popular podcasts or stream us from our website. You know, my friend Simon Rosenblatt passed on an interesting CD to me from an Orthodox musical happening in Madison Square Garden in New York called The Event. Here's a song from it, Chesed Ve'emet, Kindness and Truth. We could all use more of both, from a singer named Didi, written by Yossi Green.
Chesed Ve'emet Nifgashot Tzedek Ve'shalom Nashakot Emet Meheret Titzemach וצדק משמיים נשכח חסד ואמת נפגשו צדק ושלום נשקו אמת מארץ תצמח וצדק משמיים נשקף גם השם ייתן הטוב וארצנו תיתן
That was Chesed Ve'emet, Kindness and Truth, from The Event CD. We welcome our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbart, talking to us from Israel. Boker Tov, Guy.
Boker Tov, Rabbi. How are you?
Doing well, getting ready for the 4th of July, which is big Independence Day celebrations in America, and a time when a lot of kids are off at camp. You know, Jewish camp in America is a big part of life. Camp in Israel is also a big part of life, but it's kind of different. Talk to us a little bit about that.
Yeah, it is different. First of all, we don't call it camp. We call it machane or machane kite.
Which means camp, I might add, but that's okay.
Right, but it's more of a Hebrew sound
yes,
to it,
yes,
right?
Machane
with the
chet. Machane with a strong chet, of course, yeah.
And usually it's something that is created by the youth movements, like the Scouts or the Shomer HaTzair or other youth movements. It is by far shorter in time than the camp in the States. Well, usually kids in the States go to camp for all summer for periods of 2 weeks after 2 weeks and so on. In Israel, the summer camp is relatively short. For the fourth graders and fifth graders, it's about 3 days. For sixth graders, it's 4 days. Seventh graders go for 5 days. They go out to the forest and they basically live there for those days, including sleepover. They bring the materials and they build their own kind of shelters or houses out of natural resources in the forest, out of wood, out of rope, and basically they make everything they need on their own, and they learn how to do bonfires and how to do special ties, and they do trips around the forest and hikes. And it's a very special experience, a lot of empowerment through giving those kids the control over what's happening in the camp. Each group sits down with their guide, with their leader, and make the decisions. How do they want the area where they sleep to look like? What would they like to eat for the meal of? What would be their schedule? They're basically running the program themselves, and that gives them a lot of responsibility and a sense of leadership. And it also creates a very strong connection with nature, with care for the environment, with care for Israel, because that's the land, that's their homeland.
So a powerful connection to the land. You know, of course, Israelis all go away to camp. They just do it when they're 18 and they spend the next 3 years in the military. A little different orientation then, isn't there?
Well, yeah, I would say that, you know, when you're going to a summer camp, you're playing. When you're going to the army, well, it's probably it's not a game anymore in a sense.
Yes, of course.
Yeah.
Well, thanks, Guy. We will have a great American Independence Day, even if they don't celebrate it in Israel, and we'll talk next week.
Happy Independence Day.
When we come back, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the old Jewish joke of the week.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We started talking last week about interesting Jewish museums around the world for those people who are going on jaunts, whether or not you're traveling or just traveling through the wonders of radio with Two Jewish. What are some of the really interesting Jewish museums in Europe?
Well, assuming that people still have some travel plans ahead of them, whether it's for this summer or the fall or next
year. People always have travel plans.
One hopes. In Europe, there's countless Jewish museums, but among the great ones that come to mind quickly are Rome, Paris, Berlin, Prague, and Budapest. And let me devote at least some time to each one of those. In Rome, the Jewish Museum, which is very much worth seeing, and probably the best collection of stuff anywhere in the world about the Jewish community of Libya, or the former Jewish community of Libya and its history, which is quite distinctive. The museum is actually under the Great Synagogue, and the Great Synagogue was built after Rome was liberated and secularized, and the Pope lost control and was confined to the Vatican, and it was the first synagogue in Rome that was allowed to be higher than the surrounding buildings. So it's a magnificent building, and a visit to the museum is almost necessarily as part of a small tour group, which they form like every 20 minutes by languages. You know, it was French-speaking, English-speaking, Hebrew-speaking, whatever. Throngs of tourists in the high season, well worth joining the group, because without being in a group, you can't actually visit the synagogue that's above the museum. And this is a museum where you can easily spend half a day, and it's adjacent to the Jewish ghetto. So there's all kinds of kosher bakeries, kosher restaurants, Israeli restaurants, Jewish-themed restaurants that are sort of kosher style, whatever. But it's one of the richest Jewish museums in the world, and it's organically connected to its neighborhood and to the synagogue that's right above it. So that, I would say, is a must. Another one that's very interesting and relatively new is a museum of the history of the Jews of France, which is in what at one point in history was a Jewish quarter, the Marais, and it's built in an old sort of upper middle class hotel particulier, a sort of in-town mansion, not quite a palace, built around a courtyard. Architecturally, it's worth visiting the building just to see it, but it's a very classic sort of 18th century building. And it contains material about the Jews of France going back to the Dark Ages, going back to the 5th and 6th centuries, where there's some gravestones and some remnants of synagogues and whatever, and takes you all the way through the Jewish history of France, through Chagall and the Dreyfus Affair, and up to modern artists. The Holocaust is covered. There's a whole room there about the Dreyfus Affair. And one of the most interesting things is that they also, oddly, because many of the Jews of Paris actually come from Eastern Europe originally, they don't all come from North Africa, they come also from Poland and Hungary and Romania and whatever. So they have mock-ups of some of the old wooden synagogues in Romania. They have ritual objects to explain to people what Shabbat is and what the various chagim are and different customs like the mikvah. So you can actually learn and get a primer in sort of basic Judaism by going through this museum. And that's a museum that you can easily spend half a day in. And it's very high on my list. We'll continue next week with a couple or more.
Thanks, Tom. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. During a regular early morning shul service, Rabbi Levy couldn't help notice 25-year-old Benny sitting in the back of the shul looking very sad. He had his head in his hands. So the rabbi went over to him and asked, "What's wrong, Benny? Tell me, maybe I can help." "Oy, Rabbi," says Benny, "I just don't know what to do. Every time I bring a new girlfriend to my house and introduce her to my parents, no matter how wonderful the girl is, my mother tells me she doesn't like her." "You know, I've heard this story many times," says Rabbi Levy, "but you'll be pleased to hear that I have a tried and true solution for you. Next time you choose a girlfriend, make sure she looks like your mom, but also talks like your mom, laughs like your mom, cooks like your mom, and dresses like your mom. Believe me, Benny, if you find such a girl, your mother will love her." Weeks go by, Benny finds somebody, and not only that, the girl quickly falls madly in love with him. He invites her to meet his parents, and this time is very optimistic. But at the next Shabbos service, Rabbi Levy notices that Benny is again sitting in the back of the shul looking unbelievably unhappy. So, again, Rabbi Levy goes over to Benny. "What's wrong?" Benny asks Rabbi Levy. "Couldn't you find somebody like your mother?" "Rabbi," says Benny, "miraculously, I found a girl just like my mom. She looked like my mom, she talked like my mom, she laughed like my mom, she cooked like my mom, and dressed like my mom." "So, everything should have worked out great for you," says Rabbi Levy. "No, Rabbi, it didn't," says Benny. "My father didn't like her." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week we read the portion of Balak in the book of Numbers, which includes some of the best words an outsider ever delivered about our people. In the portion, one of just two in the whole Torah named after a non-Jew, 40 years of wandering have now passed, and the Israelites have arrived on the borders of the land of Canaan. They're about to move in, and they seem unstoppable. Balak, the king of Moab, comes up with a novel plan to stop them. He will hire Balaam, a pagan sorcerer, to curse the Israelites, which will destroy their chance of defeating his own army and entering his land. But the scheme doesn't work. Balaam may be a polytheistic prophet, but he is also an honest man who conveys only what God permits him to say. After consulting the Almighty, Balaam agrees to do the deed, but only if God permits him to do so. And so, we are given the intriguing spectacle of Balaam, the sorcerer, three times trying to curse the people of Israel, only to find that the words that come out of his mouth are not curses, but blessings. The last of these orations is a text that has become the prayer we use whenever we enter a synagogue. Ma tovu ohalecha Yaakov, how good are your tents, Jacob, your homes, Israel. Somehow, the best-laid plans of Israel's enemies go awry, transformed by the hand of God. Perhaps more importantly, the message of this portion of Balak is a subtle one. The way it works in life is that we intend to bring blessing, but bring tsaras, trouble, instead. But if we rely on God's help and inspiration, we find that even our less than nobly motivated actions can bring blessing in the place of curse. It is all a matter of remembering that the true source for inspiration and creativity and of blessing is God. When we come back on Too Jewish, our guest, actor Joshua Bitton, will explain what it's like for a Jewish actor to star in an Israeli-based film. When we come back on Too Jewish.
Safety. It's a word we take for granted at home and at the workplace. But sometimes safety isn't a sure thing. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is an environmental remediation company that's been promoting safe living in Arizona since 1989. Environmental Strategies specializes in asbestos and lead abatement, mold remediation, and industrial cleaning. In addition, they have a building and remodeling division that makes it convenient for clients to get all their services from one contractor. Environmental Strategies jobs range from seam tape removal in a single-family home to insulation removal in a Challenger Learjet aircraft, and everything in between. So, if you're in need of asbestos or lead removal, mold remediation, industrial cleaning, or top-notch general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies today at 884-1114. Estimates and bids are free and confidential. Ken Goodman is the president, and he'd love to talk with you about your project. Environmental Strategies, serving all of Arizona since 1989. Call 884-1114. We continue with our Two Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
You just knew they would find a way to blame Israel. An international incident arose when Syria shot down a Turkish military jet in its airspace. It happened because Syria thought it was an Israeli plane, a Syrian government minister said. Amran al-Zoebi, the Syrian information minister, told a Turkish news channel the confusion stemmed from the fact that both Israeli and Turkish fighter planes largely are American-made. The plane was downed last week. A second Turkish plane was downed several days later, on June 22nd, apparently also because it looked too Jewish. As you know, there's a country called Israel there, and as you know, this Zionism country's planes are very similar, and because they both are from the same factory from the U.S., maybe Syria thought it was an Israeli plane, Zoebi told the Turkish news channel. He said his government did not want to spark a crisis with Turkey. Apparently, they have enough trouble massacring their own women and children during their civil war in Syria. Turkey said its plane's entrance into Syrian airspace was an error and apologized. Perhaps the Turkish pilot simply thought that from the air, Syria looked kind of like Israel, which would again make it Israel's fault, of course, for looking too much like Syria. Shame on Israel for that. Oy. In Germany, a top Jewish leader called on the federal parliament to ensure religious freedom following a Cologne court ruling that said circumcising young boys on religious grounds amounts to grievous bodily harm. Though the decision by the District Court of Cologne does not outlaw circumcision, it is still outrageous and insensitive, Dieter Graumann, head of the Central Council of Jews in Germany, said. Ritual circumcision by a medical doctor or moyle with medical competency is an integral part of the Jewish faith that has been practiced around the world for millennia, he added. The rite is respected in every country of the world. Well, almost all. The court ruled that the fundamental right of the child to bodily integrity outweighed the fundamental rights of the parents. This decision involved a circumcision of a Muslim boy in Cologne. The parents took the four-year-old to the hospital several days after his ritual circumcision in 2010, after they became concerned about bleeding from the incision. According to reports, the bleeding was normal and quickly brought under control. However, local prosecutors filed suit against the doctor. A lower court ruled on behalf of religious freedom and the right of parents to decide, but on appeal, a higher court gave precedence to the right of the child to be protected from bodily harm, that the fundamental right of the child to bodily integrity outweighed the fundamental rights of the parents. Interestingly, I always thought Muslims circumcised at 13, but I guess it's different in different parts of the Muslim world. Anyway, the doctor was acquitted on all charges, but the ruling suggests that those performing circumcisions in the future could be committing a criminal offense, since the court now holds the right of the child sacrosanct. Berlin attorney Nathan Gelbart worries that the notion that the parents have to accept that only the child can decide about his religion after he grows up, and circumcision is therefore a pre-decision now being forced on the child. Other courts are not restricted by the decision of the Cologne court in Germany. There are 55 district courts there. The ruling might be appealed to a higher court. It is not binding unless it's a decision by the High Court of Justice in Germany. Meanwhile, Holm Putzky, a professor of criminal law at the University of Passau who has argued for years for a ban on involuntary circumcision, said he hoped the ruling would spark discussion in Germany about what should be given more weight, religious freedom or the right of children not to have their genitals mutilated. You know, I find it inappropriately entertaining that the principal legal figure seeking to outlaw circumcision in Germany is named Putzky. You see, Putz is a Yiddish word for the organ in question. Anyway, in late 1999, Germany's top court ruled in favor of religious freedom in a sort of similar case, protecting the right to Islamic ritual slaughter and, by association, kosher slaughter. That ruling came after an Islamic butcher challenged a 1995 German law banning the slaughter of animals without stunning them first, which is against the laws of both kashrut and halal. In other news, a former commander of the Palestinian terrorist group Hamas's armed wing was found guilty in court, and part of Hamas is not armed, oh well, was found guilty in court of the deaths of 46 people in terror attacks. Ibrahim Hamed, a former commander of the Izz al-Din al-Qassam brigades of Hamas, was convicted in an Israeli military court last week on 46 counts of murder, as well as 4 counts of accessory to murder and 4 counts of attempted murder. Hamed was convicted of being the terrorist architect of several deadly attacks inside Israel, including 3 in Jerusalem, Zion Square in 2001, which killed 10 people, Cafe Moment in 2002, which killed 11, and Cafe Hillel in 2003, which killed 7 and wounded 57. Prosecutors asked that Hamed be sentenced to 56 life sentences. He was arrested in the West Bank in 2006. His house was demolished by the IDF in 2003, and his family deported to Jordan. And our good news department, and boy, we need it, tells us the establishment of the Genesis Prize, which is being touted as a Jewish Nobel Prize and worth $1 million to the recipient, was announced last week. The international prize came in a statement from the office of Israeli Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu. It included Jewish Agency Chairman Natan Sharansky and Genesis Philanthropy Group founder Michael Friedman. The prize will be awarded to Jews who win global recognition for their professional achievements, including in the world of science and the arts. The Genesis Philanthropy Group, which will fund the prize, is comprised of several oligarchs from the former Soviet Union who are committed to building the Russian-speaking Jewish diaspora. Israel's prime minister will award the prize at an annual ceremony to be held near Pesach. A selection committee made up of retired judges and diaspora Jewish community leaders, as well as representatives from the Prime Minister's office and the Genesis Group, will choose the winner in a multi-stage process. The Genesis Prize emphasizes the contribution of the Jews to world history, Friedman said. Far-reaching achievements in science, the arts, business, medicine, diplomacy, and other fields of human endeavor have been realized thanks to the Jewish people's natural aspiration to improve the world and to its desire to pass its moral values on to coming generations. This tradition of the Jewish people must continue. Stan Polovitz, the CEO and co-founder of Genesis, said that Friedman first came up with the idea for the prize, which in turn was developed during the past 3 years in partnership with Natan Sharansky, Netanyahu, and the Prime Minister's staff. Our foundation, the Jewish Agency, under Natan Sharansky, are focusing on ensuring that the next generation of Jews grows up with a strong sense of Jewish identity and Jewish values, Polovitz said. By recognizing the achievements and accomplishments of Jews worldwide, the Genesis Group hopes to inspire younger Jews to embrace the idea of belonging to the Jewish people and strengthening their sense of Jewish identity. Well, good luck. And that's the news of Jews round the world.
We welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning, Joshua Bitton. He stars in the new film For the Love of Money, the true story of an Israeli whose journey to America from gangster background and trouble in Israel to success in America and back into gangster trouble in America is very interesting and colorful. Josh Bitton grew up in New York, made his, I guess, his big first hit in the Pacific, Spielberg and Hanks's miniseries, the second installment of The Band of Brothers, in which he played a private improbably named J.P. Morgan, as I recall. Along with a variety of roles in film and TV, Josh has worked extensively in the theater. He's done off-Broadway productions of Romeo and Juliet, The Seagull, and many other plays, and regionally he's worked all around the country. He got his master's in fine arts from Rutgers University, my mom's alma mater, by the way, and has attended Stuyvesant High. So good to have you back, Josh. Good morning.
Good to be back. Good morning.
So when you pick a role, is there ever sort of a Jewish element to what you're looking for? Does it come out in your work?
Well, you know, this role in For the Love of Money was pretty remarkable for me because, you know, my father is Moroccan, and then moved to Israel, fought the Six-Day War. They grew up in Be'er Sheva, quite poor, and elements of this film mirrored that of my family in a really strong way, including, you know, some of the sordid, you know, gangster elements that are in this film. You know, you grow up a Moroccan Jew in Israel. There's going to be members of your family who are in the military and are as good and clean as they come, and there are members of your family that go the other way. And so I was familiar with this story in my own way, and it was a pretty amazing experience because when I read the script, I called my brother and I said, someone wrote a movie that's so similar to our father's life. And it was a pretty amazing journey to dive into and really quite personal. I've only had that a couple times in my career, and when they come up, it's really exciting. I did a play by Alfred Uhry called The Last Night of Ballyhoo.
Yeah, it's a Jewish story, Last Night of Ballyhoo.
Yeah, and that very much reminded me a lot of my mother, who is a Polish whose mother survived the war, and she was born in a DP camp in Germany. And when they moved to New York, my mom told me about how, you know, they were told as Polish Jews there were certain temples they couldn't go to, because those were reserved for the Western European Jews who were considered, you know, a higher level. And when I read Ballyhoo, I had the same experience that I did when I read For the Love of Money, which was, wow, this is telling a story that is so personally relatable to me and my own family's experience. Though when they come up, it's pretty exciting.
When you, by the way, has your dad seen any of the rushes from the film? Have you shown any of them to him?
I showed him he saw the trailer, posted it all over the place, was so excited, and that him, my brother, and I are all traveling to Israel to go to the Israeli premiere after the premiere here in Los Angeles, and my family's pretty excited.
I'll bet. You know, most American Jews think of Israel in terms of the Ashkenazic history. If they know much about it, they tend to think about the Zionists and the pioneers and all of that. And everybody was upstanding and everybody lived on a kibbutz. But that wasn't really how it was for a lot of Israelis, particularly Jews from Morocco, Iraq. And there was a big Moroccan subculture in Israel, and they felt discriminated against. Did your dad ever talk about that stuff too?
Very, very, very much. I mean, that was definitely his experience. You know, my father, when I was growing up, I grew up in New York, as you introduced me, and, you know, you see, you know, people of all different races all around you. My father owned a store in Harlem, a clothing store, small clothing store, and that was sort of how he got his start in sort of building towards his American dream. And, you know, he used to describe to me, he said, you know, you see how the blacks and the Latinos are discriminated against here in New York. And as a kid, you know, you could see it from the way the cops treated them to just sort of socioeconomically what was going on in those neighborhoods. He said, this was us in Israel. You know, we were the lowest class. People talked down to us. It was hard to get work, you know, and a lot of ways, I think it's those elements that create that sort of, you know, that outside of the law, you know, approach to success, because they felt like outsiders. And what's amazing about it is that, you know, they moved from Morocco to Israel in the same way I see a lot of Israelis moving to the States, right, for that American dream. They went there for a better opportunity and felt like when he got there that they were not quite as welcome as they anticipated.
Yeah, you know, it's funny, discrimination, and we don't like to talk about it. We like to say, Kulanu Yehudim, everybody's Jewish, everybody's the same. Well, just because we don't like to talk about it doesn't mean there isn't discrimination, doesn't exist.
Exactly.
That comes out in the film, too.
Yeah, it does. I mean, it definitely does. You know, just from the fact of them being Israeli and being in the States and how difficult it was. You know, I mean, you see, you know, like everyone, you see it on TV. I see it in a film, and it seems like, oh, that's a place that I can go and I can live that dream. And then you get here, and, you know, the doors aren't so open, you know, which is what makes Isaac's story so amazing, is because this guy, talking about hustle, talking about never quitting, he really pushed through anything. And he is such a remarkable success story. He's done so well. He's got beautiful kids, you know, and
who are not gangsters, by the way.
Who are not gangsters. And the thing about Isaac, too, is he is a legitimate businessman. There's nothing that he has done that was illegal. His family became embroiled because of his cousin. And his cousin, you know, got out of prison in Israel, came here, got into trouble here, and my Israeli relatives here remember the event that is sort of the climactic moment of this film. They said, oh, yeah, of course, on Fairfax, you know, and, they remember exactly what happened because it was a big deal, and in the Israeli community it was massive.
When you go to Israel for the premiere, what do you expect?
You know, it's interesting because Yehuda Levy, you know, when we were shooting the film here, would talk about how he's a lead in our film, what a different experience it was for him because he's a big star there. You know, he's a really big star in Israel, and here
he's a huge movie star there.
Huge movie star, and the you know some Israelis would show up at set because they knew who he was.
Oh, yeah,
but we could go out, have dinner, you know, what have you, and he wasn't really bothered. My brother was just. We've been getting calls and emails and Facebooks and all this kind of stuff from all our family because apparently the commercial and posters are everywhere because it's a Yehuda Levy movie. He's like, this guy's like Brad Pitt over there. So I'm not really sure what to expect because I think we're going to have a nice, you know, opening here in LA and New York. But I think in Israel, it's all over the place. It's a major film. So I don't know. I'm excited, to be honest.
You know, I have to say, the thing about big stars, big heroes, important people in Israel is everybody treats everybody like they're their cousin.
Absolutely. Yes. And, you know, my father is one of 12, and his mother was one of 12.
Holy cow.
So I have...
You have more cousins. You have more cousins than the rest of us have entire families.
It's exactly right. And now, you know, I'm getting emails and posts from... people I've never met, but they're like, I'm your cousin. I can't wait for the movie. And, you know, it's sort of...
Can I get free tickets? And will you take
exactly.
me out to dinner afterwards? And is there a reception backstage?
We're going to need a stadium to screen this thing just to house my family.
Just for your family. What's your next project, Josh?
I just finished a really, I thought, poignant guest star on an NBC show called Harry's Law, mm-hmm. and then I am actually in the midst of writing a screenplay based on my family with a dear friend of mine who's a really fantastic writer named John Polono, and you know, and then we'll see what comes after that. It's been a good, steady, busy time, so I'm sure something's around the corner.
Josh, the film is going to be out, For the Love of Money. People should look for it. Premiering in L.A., premiering in Israel, hopefully a fairly broad release. I'm sure that Jewish movie festivals will have it if it doesn't get everywhere. Do you know how broad it's going to be out?
Well, right now the release is L.A. and New York, limited, I think, in a handful of theaters in both cities for opening. You know, there's some really interesting actors in it. You know, James Caan is in it, and Jeffrey Tambor, and Paul Sorvino, and, you know, there's Odette Fehr. So if the film does as well as, I guess, prior screenings have lent it to be, it might spread, which is, I think, their hope. And like I said, in Israel, it's opening on hundreds of screens. So it'll be open all over the place. And if it does well there, I wouldn't be surprised if it doesn't get releases in some other cities around the world, you know, because it's sort of like a foreign film in a way.
Absolutely. Did you have a chance to work with James Caan at all?
I did.
How was that?
I did. It was amazing. I mean, one, just being a kid from Queens to work with, you know, one of the most successful actors from Queens ever. I'm a guy who was in The Godfather, you know, that's just the Sonny Corleone. So that's just about as exciting as it gets. And then he couldn't have been just a cooler neighborhood kind of guy, more so. He was just, you know, he was funny. He was on top of it. You know, he's a real pro. And I got along with him really well. So it was really fun.
Josh, thanks for a great visit on Too Jewish. The film is called For the Love of Money. Joshua Bitton, and I'm sure you'll see him on TV and in films and on stages near you for a long time. Thanks very much, Josh.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
And mazel tov on the film.
Thank you.
When we come back, we'll hear about next week's guest, get a final musical play out here on Too Jewish.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday at 9 o'clock. Our guest will be Josh Perlman, the curator of the American Jewish History Museum, on their exciting new exhibit of George Washington's famous letter to the Jews of Newport, Rhode Island, to bigotry, no sanction, and so on. And of course, listen to all of our podcasts on iTunes or our TooJewishRadio.com website. Email us at TooJewishRadio@Yahoo.com and like us on Facebook. Our playout this morning comes from the very silly songs of Doug Kotler for the upcoming Independence Day. It's called Jewish USA. My friends, have a great 4th of July and a Shavuot Tov, a good week and a week, we pray, of peace.
If everybody had a Torah across the USA.